Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for regular host David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Travis Stanzel, and our director is Henry Frayne. Glad you could listen today. Until about 30 years ago, women's history wasn't taken seriously as an academic field. During this hour, Focus 580, we'll talk with someone who pretty much founded the field. Our guest, Gerda Lerner, has accomplished a number of very important things in her academic career. Her books, The Creation of Patriarchy and The Creation of Feminist Consciousness, have become classics, and her 1997 book, Why History Matters, was a bestseller. She helped establish Women's History Month as an annual observance and created a guide to resources on women's history for the U.S. archives used by scholars across the U.S. Gerda Lerner has worked almost her entire life as an activist, and she says her life experiences made her work not just an occupation, but an obligation. Her life before academia is the subject of her new book, which we'll discuss during this hour. The book is Fireweed, a Political Autobiography, published recently by Temple University Press. In the book, Gerda Lerner discusses her formative childhood experiences in Austria, her flight from Nazi occupation in 1938, her activism in the anti-fascist movement in the U.S. and later in the Communist Party, and her subsequent disillusionment with Marxism, her role in the civil rights movement, and her aspirations as a writer, which led her to scholarship, and her role as a founder of women's history studies. There is much more in the book, and we'll talk with Gerda Lerner during this hour about her personal history has informed her scholarly career and her lifelong struggle for justice. We should mention also that Gerda Lerner will be in Champaign-Urbana this Wednesday evening and will be speaking in the Center for Advanced Study Millercom Lecture Series, 7:30 p.m. this Wednesday at the Levis Faculty Center in Urbana on the third floor. And the title of her talk, A Life Struggle for Justice, Gerda Lerner and Her Political Autobiography, Fireweed, which we'll discuss during this hour. As we talk with Gerda Lerner, you are invited into the conversation. We welcome your questions. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. You're free to join our conversation. And let's say good morning to Gerda Lerner, who joins us by telephone. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for the nice introduction, Mr. Brighton.
Well, thank you so much for your time today.
It's an honor to be there.
Well, we're honored to have you. There's a lot I want to talk about, and please feel free to direct us in any way you'd like. I have a few basic questions, but we can take the conversation anywhere that suits you as well.
You're fading away a little bit.
Okay, I'll try to speak
That's
up.
Better.
Okay.
Yes.
You say in the book that you couldn't write this story until very recently. Obviously, many parts of the story are traumatic, and I think you acknowledge they were very painful to recount. My question is, why was it important for you to write it?
First of all, I'm a historian, and historians are always occupied with documenting the past and verifying the past. And as I'm getting older, I have the same impulse to make sure that my own life is recorded, in the full roundness of its experience. And I thought I could do that better than could strangers that would look in the records in the archives later. And that was the reason I wanted to do that. And also, I feel that my own experience as a sort of a person of the old left, who then went on to make an impact on society, that's something that should be acknowledged and not hidden.
Yes. Well, there are so many chapters in your life that are worth exploring in terms of even the issues that we're dealing with today.
Right. I think that's true. And I have a very strong feeling, too, that, I spent many years as a teacher and that the young people today have a very short historical memory, if any. you know, 20 years, 40 years seems to them, that's history. And I think it's very important for younger people to understand what the generation of their grandparents lived through and what our experience was. So that's a very personal motivation. I have four grandchildren, and I'm very close to them. And I guess that had an impact on me, too.
Mm-hmm. I think also it's very interesting to read about your experiences when you were very young and sort of finding the places where a sense of injustice can originate.
Uh-huh. Well, I have had an unusual experience for which is not shared by native-born Americans, but it is rather usual for immigrant Americans, because most of us come here or came here to try to escape some sort of persecution and injustice in our the countries of our birth, you know. And I had the experience of being raised in a very privileged, comfortable, caring household, you know. And then from one day to the next, being redefined by other people in such a way that everything was taken away from me. And I had to confront life not just as being underprivileged, but below even the discussion of privilege, because what the Nazi government did in Austria, and in much faster than they had done it in Germany, was to remove, you know, all, if you were Jewish, you were forbidden to have any employment whatsoever. You were excluded from the schools and universities. You were, your assets were frozen, if you had any, if your family had assets. And then a few months later, we were simply destined to be expropriated. And then finally, you know, several years later, killed. That was it. So, but in my case, by emigrating at that time, I lost my citizenship. And I think it's very important to know what an utterly traumatic thing it is to be deprived of citizenship, because it means you are no longer a human being. Anything can happen to you. Nobody cares. You have nobody that you can appeal to, you know. And when you've had that experience and you survive it, you learn certain things from it. And some are bad. Some are good.
Yes. In reading your account of the Anschluss and the reaction of so many people in Austria, it strikes me that sometimes goodwill between human beings can be a very fragile thing, or at least that intolerance of the other, however that's defined, where yeah. can surface very quickly.
Well, that's the bad lesson, you know. That's a terrible lesson, that when societies tolerate intolerance and foster it, and when they foster the hatred of one group or another, you know, then otherwise decent human beings just fall in line. And that's a very frightening experience when it happens to you personally, when you go to school and your schoolmates don't talk to you anymore, you know, and you have friendships with people and they just drop you like a hot potato. They don't want to be near you. They don't want to be seen near you. Well, I was imprisoned as a hostage for my father, who had left the country, who had fled the country. And when I came out of prison, one of my best girlfriends from school, who was a Gentile, heard about it and wanted to show her friendship, but she didn't want to be seen with me, okay? So she met me a few blocks away from my house and walked with me to school, but a few blocks away from the school, she said, I'll stay behind. You go ahead and I'll go in later. You know.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing that hurts you more, perhaps, than even outright violence. And that made a very lasting impact on me, that experience, because it showed me how powerful social definitions are, you know. And the definition where you define a group as deviant or non-human or below human dignity or whatever, and then you act on that, I mean, you can only commit injustice one way or the other. And when I began to study this and when I began to work on the history of women, I realized that women had been defined as a group to be the other of men and had been, as a group, discriminated against for thousands of years. And it was no more just than the kind of redefinition I underwent when I was in Austria.
When you were arrested and imprisoned in Austria, as you mentioned, and underwent a very horrible time there, I guess I'm wondering, how did that experience affect your political convictions?
Well, that's one thing that is important for us to understand today. When people are unjustly persecuted, and when they're terrorized, and when they are unjustly imprisoned, that doesn't make them better and nicer and more loving people. That makes them angry. It makes them, you know, makes them less tolerant of other people, because the anger and the resentment is something that builds up. And I think it kind of radicalizes you. And I think we need to understand that in the relationships that we have, that our nation has with other people in the world. We're not seen, you know, we're not seen objectively when people are victimized. They don't feel they focus on their victimization, and that's the way I felt. I felt I was unjustly imprisoned, and I had to focus on surviving it. And the people who I was imprisoned with, the other fellow prisoners, were very politically oriented, and that made me more political.
And when you were let out, essentially, it seemed, in reading your account of it, you were not, it did not, you know, make you shy about expressing your point of view. It did not make you give up in your quest for justice.
No, on the contrary, I think I got stronger out of it. I got more courageous because I learned that I could survive the persecution. It did make me more, I think, more self-confident, and also more dedicated to eradicating this kind of fascist regime. You know, I was I felt very strongly about that. I felt that I had to do more than just save my own life. You know,
yeah.
So it made me more politically committed, I would say, to being an anti-fascist at the time. Well, that doesn't mean anything to people today, but it meant being against the regimes that were, you know, the persecuting and killing people just for who they are, who they were born.
We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's include them in our
conversation. Oh, already? You have callers. That's
yes.
Wonderful.
Yeah, people would like to speak with you. Let me take a moment, though, to reintroduce our guest. If you have joined us in the last few minutes, we're talking with Gerda Lerner. She is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and she is one of the founders of the field of women's history in the United States. And we're talking with her about her book, Fireweed, a Political Autobiography, published by Temple University Press. She'll be in Champaign-Urbana to speak this Wednesday evening at 7:30 at the Levis Faculty Center, a Millicom lecture. In the meantime, we have a couple callers and would welcome others. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. This is a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. What a pleasure to have you here in town. I've read some of your books and was very awakened by them.
Oh, nice.
But I was very curious when you talked about being in prison in Austria, and I was curious at what age, and I wasn't aware that anybody who was picked up by the Nazi government and put in prison ever got out. So if you don't mind sharing that unpleasant time, more details.
Well, I was I celebrated my 18th birthday in jail. So that answers your question about the age. And yes, there were people who were let out, but only if they were not politically active, okay? If they were arrested just in a street arrest or something like that, or random arrest for no particular reason, they were let out. The Nazis expected, and in many cases it worked, that these people would then be intimidated, you know. And in my case, I wasn't accused of anything. I was a hostage. They wanted my father to come back from abroad because they were hoping to expropriate him faster than they could do it otherwise. And they probably also wanted to... They would have jailed him. That's why he escaped, that he had been warned that he was on the list to be arrested.
Did you have siblings and a mother?
What?
Did you have siblings and...
Yeah, I had a sibling. I have a sister, and my mother was arrested with me. So my mother and I were the hostages. My sister was just 12 years old, so they let her go.
It was a horrific time, and
yeah. But as far as I think you have to understand that it's not like in the movies, you know. Under all conditions, under oppression and under oppressive regimes, there are all kinds of levels of stories. You know, some people are tortured, some people are not. Some people are sentenced unjustly for long sentences. Others are never even tried, or never have a day in court. You know, it's very arbitrary. Part of it is the arbitrariness is very terrible.
Yeah. But well, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for your question.
The your description of trying to get out of Austria is another harrowing experience, where the layers of bureaucracy were essentially, I think, you know, as you describe it, they were essentially perfecting a system of torture, for people who essentially they were making stateless. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about trying to get away from Austria and essentially eventually to the United States, where, again, there were layers of bureaucracy and not a lot of sympathy.
Well, that's an interesting question because I learned something in the writing of the autobiography that I didn't know about this, because the way in which we were let out of jail, my mother and I, and forced, before we left, we had to sign a statement that we would immediately leave Austria, which was in effect making us sign our own order of deportation and renunciation of our citizenship. So it's no small matter. You're not accused of any crime. You haven't done anything wrong. And the next thing you know is you have a choice. Either you rot in jail for the rest of your life or you sign a piece of paper. And we signed it. You know, what were we going to do? And then we found that, and they made us report to the police every week, and we found that there were, you know, half a dozen papers that you had to get before you could leave, to leave legally. And to leave illegally, you would be shot on sight if they caught you. So it wasn't like a small matter. And each time we came to the police station, they abused us and threatened us and told us the next time if we weren't gone, they were going to send us to the concentration camp. So it was very, very unpleasant. And what I learned when I wrote the this my own memories, you know, I thought I would read up a little bit on the recent historical scholarship in Austria about that period. And lo and behold, I find out that about 2 weeks before we came out of jail, the Nazis had installed a new person to handle what they called the expropriation of the Jews of Vienna, okay? Mm-hmm. And apparently the idea was that when they had expropriated the Jews of Germany, it took them 6 years and they still hadn't done it. There were still millions of them in Germany at that time. I'm talking about 1938. Mm-hmm. And the person they put in charge of this was a young SS lieutenant who had no record of any sort, and his name was Adolf Eichmann. And it turns out it was Eichmann who designed the every bureaucratic obstacle with a clear viewpoint that if you tortured people sufficiently and humiliated them daily and made them stand in line forever and never gave them the papers that they needed, they would leave voluntarily. And I had not known that. And it is, in fact, very interesting because Eichmann, when he was tried as a war criminal, he was tried for his, for his handling of the final solution, and he claimed that he was just an instrument carrying it out. In fact, he was the one who designed the system that then was returned back to Germany and used to enable the Germans to do this final solution thing. That means, but in case people don't know what that is,
sure,
they meant by the final solution, killing every Jewish man, woman, and child that they could catch, whether they were German or not.
There are a bunch of chapters that that go between that point and the point where you arrive in the United States, and we're almost at our midpoint already, and obviously we're not going to be able to cover everything. But I did want to ask you to sort of talk about the transition to the United States, where again there were layers of bureaucratic problems to deal with, and you were essentially very, very lucky and one of the very few people who were actually able to make the trip to the United States, and it was because of the efforts of your fiancé and his family who had already arrived here.
Yeah, well, it was, you can only simply say that the United States government at the time did nothing special to save the lives of any Jews, which is very different from the policy that was pursued later during the Cold War, where we instituted all kinds of measures to rescue people who faced death and persecution. Mm-hmm. But we had a system of immigration based on the immigration law of 1924, and it was a system based on quotas. Every country had quotas. That is, and the quotas favored northern and Western European countries. So if you were born in Germany or France, you had a better chance of a quota number that would allow you to enter the United States. But if you were born in Hungary, as my mother was, when she applied for immigration, she was told that there was an 8-year waiting period. Well, we didn't have 8 years, you know. So it was very, very discouraging. But the important thing is, some people got into the country, and I think we're eternally grateful for that.
But many of your family did not get into the country.
No, I could never bring my family over. I tried very hard, but I could not.
And you knew what was essentially happening in Europe, that war was descending, that...
Yeah, we knew that. We knew that. We expected the war to break out. We didn't know when, but we expected it, you know, daily or every month. And it was a very difficult time. But anyway, to come back to the question of the definition, you know,
yeah.
I think it's very important that people think about what we are doing when we talk about groups of people and define them in one way or another. You know, whatever the group is that we pick on, sometimes we pick on welfare mothers, and we say welfare mothers are this or that, but that's not what they are. They're individuals, and each has a story, and each is a human being.
Or we say Muslims or terrorists or whatever.
Yeah, right. In other words, I think that is, to me, is really something I very deeply believe in, and that we have to stop dividing people into the good ones and the bad ones, or them and us, you know. That's the ultimate evil. Once you do that, it doesn't matter who the target group is. I feel that very strongly.
When you arrived in the United States, there are a number of things that happened, obviously, that...
Well, you're taking us through the entire book.
I'm trying to.
I don't know if we can get it.
No, I don't think so either. But I did want to talk about the story of your second husband, Carl Lerner, who was a director and film editor, and your experiences in Hollywood with the labor movement and the Communist Party and the conflict that happened during the 40s and 50s.
Well, we were in Hollywood. I mean, we came to Hollywood because Carl had been unemployed, like many artists. He was a stage director in New York, you know. At the time, there was a big depression, and all the federal government had a program called the Federal Theater, where they used gave work to unemployed actors and directors. And then after a while, that was abolished as being too expensive. And so he was unemployed, and in order to find work, some of his former friends had gone to Hollywood and had found work in the film industry, and they urged us to come there, and we did that. And at the time we came to Hollywood, the film industry was just undergoing a big change. They had operated for a long time on a basis of no unions at all, or what they called company unions, that is, unions that were heavily influenced and corrupted by the company and did whatever the company told them to. And just before we got there, there had been several unions, the screenwriters and the Screen Actors Guild, that had a progressive leadership and that had fought the studios to really get better conditions. And what I'm talking about is kind of ironic, because at the time, what they were fighting against was the 70 and 80-hour work week. You know,
yeah.
People were working forever. They weren't being paid overtime, and they had to be accessible for their jobs on almost an unlimited basis. And then when the unionization took place, this was reduced to 8-hour days with overtime pay and no obligation to work 70 and 80 hours a week. The reason it's ironic is that right now we're back to 70-hour weeks in Hollywood again. But the pay is better, so the unions did accomplish something.
Uh-huh.
And we were involved in that. We got very involved in that struggle for unionization, and my husband was very active in that. And we went through all kinds of, struggles with the unions. And then a few years later, You know, you had the Cold War beginning, and the climate was changing, and the various committees started investigating Hollywood for communist influence. And what it really amounted to, what the real agenda was, union busting, to get the progressive unions under the control of people who didn't believe in unions that helped the working people.
Mm-hmm.
And so then this was the period when there was the blacklist in Hollywood, and people were, again, being defined as the other. Now they were the Reds in Hollywood. And it's interesting that with all the investigations, they never found any, they never found a single film that they could say was a film that was subversive, except one film that was made at the urging of the State Department during the war. I think it was called The Song of Russia or something,
mm-hmm.
which was pro-Russian. So that was while we were, while the Russians were fighting and we were allied with them. So, but they never were able to prove any film that had been influenced in a way. And, of course, the whole idea that writers or actors or directors could influence the content of a motion picture was absurd to anyone who knew how pictures were made. They're all very heavily influenced by the producers, and there's a constant check on every shot and every line that's spoken by numbers of people. So even if somebody wanted to smuggle in some subversive message, it would be almost impossible. So we went through that struggle, and I can't really talk about it in detail because you have to read the background, but that
sure.
I describe some of the work there. And then my husband was blacklisted, and that meant that we were back to square one. We couldn't get work.
It was a parallel to your experience in Austria in many ways, wasn't it?
Well, it felt like it to me. It wasn't a parallel totally because the intent, the intention wasn't to kill people.
Right.
So it was, we survived it. But it was very difficult. It was a difficult period. We had a young family then. And then Carl went back to New York and built up a very fine reputation as an editor in New York. And one of the ironies is, he was the film editor that made 12 Angry Men, the film that's a classic, everybody has seen it, with Henry Fonda. And he had a very good career in Hollywood, in New York then, after we went through a very hard patch before, during the blacklist period. And I also write about my life as a writer. I tried to become an American writer from the time that I came to America. And that was also a very up and down sort of career, I want to stop for a moment and
okay.
give you a chance to have a... Or if you have any questions from
sure.
the audience.
Well, let me just take a moment then to reintroduce you. Our guest today is Gerda Lerner. She is a professor emeritus of history at University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's had a long career in the academic field of women's history as one of the founders of the field, and her books are very well known. We're discussing her latest book, Fireweed, A Political Autobiography. And let me mention again that Gerda Lerner will be in Champaign-Urbana this Wednesday evening at 7:30. She'll be giving a lecture at the Levis Faculty Center. This is a Millicom lecture, and she'll be talking about her book. And that is free and open to the public. And also, I'll mention the phone numbers one more time. We have just about maybe 12 minutes left during this hour. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana and elsewhere, 800-222-9455. I actually did want to ask you to talk a little bit about your activism during this period, especially with the Congress of American Women, and how you learned through that experience how real people organize as opposed to simply theorizing about organizing.
Right. I mean, I think that was very important. And as I look back on my life, I found that it's more important than I realized, because I was always interested in pursuing academic study, but of course it was made impossible by the experience of fascism, and I graduated from the equivalent of high school in Vienna with a Nazi commission examining me one day after I got out of jail, you know. Mm-hmm. So I did manage that, but then for 20 years I couldn't go back to school because I was too poor and I had to work for a living and I had a family and so on. So when I look back on those years, those 20 years, in which most of the time I was active in the community where I lived, whichever community it was. And I worked on the level of very simple neighborhood organizing. And since I always was interested in women, I was always interested in organizing the women that were my neighbors. And they were mostly housewives of various, you know, kinds. And I was active after the war in getting child care established and in getting a pre-kindergarten or kindergarten program into the public schools. That was an issue. And then we worked on issues like the price of meat that was enormously increased after the end of the war. And we organized neighborhood meat boycotts and brought the price of meat down, things like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I could go on, you know, for hours on the various activities. I was also very interested always in peace, the issue of peace and the control of nuclear weapons. And so I organized peace committees and I went around with peace petitions. I was involved in electoral politics in California and in New York. You know,
one of the lessons that you draw from this experience stems.
Well, yeah.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, when I think that I went through all that practical experience before I ever entered college. You know, and I entered college when I was 38 years old as an undergraduate, and then they gave me some credit for my European training. So it took me 4 years to get a BA part-time, you know. Mm-hmm. And then I went from that to graduate school at Columbia, and I went from the BA, and I earned an MA and a PhD in 3 years. Mm-hmm. And I had to do everything that everybody else had to do. So I was able to do it in record time. Mm-hmm. Because I had the motivation, you know. To
Definitely.
Me, this was like the most wonderful, joyous experience of my life, that I had the time to study. But what I learned was that I would come into classes. I never had a female teacher in college. And there weren't any in the department. There was one teaching, I think, Byzantine history, and that was it. And then I would be presented with a history of the past in which there were no women. And I would ask them, why aren't you telling us what the women did? And if they answered at all, they would say, well, they didn't do anything important. And I knew that that was wrong. I knew from my own experience that if you wanted to change something in any community, anywhere in the world, you had to get the women to do it, or it wouldn't get done. And I knew that. So that drove me into women's history. At the time, women's history was not recognized. It didn't exist. Nobody knew what it was. And in fact, it was ridiculed. And you know, we were told it was a fad and it would go nowhere mm-hmm. and so on. But the fact of the matter is that I felt that the people who were teaching me, who I had great respect for their knowledge, but they only knew half the story, you know?
Yeah.
So in that sense, my practical experience was a great asset to me in helping to develop this field. Because I knew by, and the same way, I published a book in 1972 called Black Women in White America, which was a compilation of primary sources on the history of black women. At the time I published that book, every knowledgeable person in the field told me there was no such thing as a history of black women, all right? And I knew there was because I had worked and organized with black women for decades. I had actually worked with them in the community, and I knew they were active, and I knew they had done great things, and they had to have done that in the past, too.
There's a story you tell about that. I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about when you were organizing with the Congress of American Women. There were a couple of African American women who were part of your group who at first it seems didn't really respond in the way you thought that they might, and one of them seemed shy and you know not exactly engaged, and you were talking about probably very global issues that you were dealing with, and you had an experience with them where you actually had one of the meetings in their house. And that seemed to kind of change at least your notion of who they were and how maybe you should be approaching the issue of grassroots.
Well, it changed our racist attitude.
Yeah.
I mean, they didn't ever call us on it, but they just held back. You know, they came to our meetings and they would participate in the discussion very, very, very modestly, very little. And in fact, we white women then made comments about why didn't they participate more and were they shy, or it was all their fault, you know, and from our point of view. That was our attitude. And then we had this incident where one of the black women brought a raffle book of raffle tickets to sell, and it was for children to go on a summer camp in her community. And we were very unenthusiastic about this. We wanted to change, you know, we wanted to work for world peace, and we wanted to work for more feminist goals of the equality of women and so on. And then one of the women said, "My children need to go to camp this summer. They can't wait," which was very, I mean, that was a hard-hitting thing to say. And so we took those raffle books, and after she left, we had the first time we confronted the fact that we weren't really responding to their concerns. Whenever they said something about their community, it wasn't of interest to us. And that's how we recognized that, in a way, that was a racist thing we were doing. And so we decided to go to their home. And then it turned out that they were far from, these women were extraordinary community leaders. One of them belonged to something like 15 organizations. They had leadership positions in their community. They were middle class, highly educated women. They were extremely talkative and had a lot to say. But they just weren't going to do it until we changed our attitude. And they became very, very close friends. And when I left Los Angeles, one of them gave a party for about 80 people in her house for me, a farewell party. And I learned a lot from that, because that's something that, you know, that's the kind of unconscious racism that people project and that hurts African-American people when it's done to them. And I thought I thought I wasn't capable of doing such a thing, but yet I was. And it's something that you have to be conscious of. So it was experiences like that that made me interested in asking about the history of black women, you know. And at the time, when we were just struggling for a recognition of the history of women altogether, this was considered a very odd interest. People didn't think it was going to go, but this is my best-selling book, Black Women in White America. It's still alive and well and has been used extensively all over the nation.
We just have about 2 minutes left. There's so much more we could talk about. I guess I'm curious about your assessment of where we are in terms of women's history. If, you know, after some 30 years and efforts of you and many other people.
Well, I think we have made a lot of progress in recognizing women's history. We have instituted courses and graduate programs and women's studies programs in many, many universities. And women's history is being taught on the high school level, and it's even being taught on the elementary school level. And some of the basic tests that are being given to school children now include some questions in women's history, which is very important. So I think it's been one of the areas where we've made the greatest progress in the women's movement. And the fact that we have Women's History Month and Women's History Days and that we give prizes in the schools, all those things are very significant. I think that we have not done too well in general in maintaining strong commitment to the teaching of history as a whole in the school system. I'm talking about up to K-12. I think many, many places they use social studies instead of history courses and so on. So that's not good. But women's history as an academic field is really been very well established, and it's growing, and it is a field that many students now take as a minor field, whatever their other interests, so that they have a gender perspective in their work. And also, what I find very gratifying, many people that go into government services or education or even in corporate administrations have found that having training in women's history is very helpful for them,
mm-hmm.
because it teaches you that to be sensitive to the issues that women are raising and also to the injustices that are perpetrated still against women as a group. So I think we have made very good progress on that, and I think it's irreversible progress. Today, I think the people expect to hear about women when they hear about men. And that certainly wasn't the case 30 years ago or 40 years ago.
We'll have to leave it there since we're out of our time. But I want to say to folks, if you're in Champaign-Urbana, on Wednesday evening, our guest Gerda Lerner will be speaking at the Levis Faculty Center, 7:30 p.m. on the third floor. Her lecture in the Millicom series entitled A Life of Struggle for Justice, Gerda Lerner and her political autobiography, Fireweed. And the book Fireweed is published by Temple University Press. You should be able to find that in bookstores and libraries. It's a great read, very dramatic story, and so I'd highly recommend it. And to you, Gerda Lerner, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Brighton. I really enjoyed the opportunity.
Hope
and I hope to see a lot of people at the lecture.
Very good. Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.